Hi, I'm Malcolm Hawker, and this is the CDO Matters podcast, the show where I dig deep into the strategic insights, best practices, and practical recommendations that modern data leaders need to help their organizations become truly data-driven. Tune in for thought-provoking discussions with data, IT, and business leaders to learn about the CDO matters that are top of mind for today's chief data officers. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good whatever time it is, wherever you are in this amazing planet of ours. I am Malcolm Hawker. I am your host today on the CDO Matters podcast. I'm also the Chief Data Officer of Prophecy. I am thrilled to be joined by our returning champion. Our returning champion, if this was Jeopardy. By the way, if you were ever on Jeopardy, my money's on you, my friend. This is Mark Stuess, our returning champion, who would be amazing at Jeopardy, I'm sure. Tell the truth, Mark. Do you annoy your family when Jeopardy's on? Like,
I hardly watch any TV.
Oh, you don't watch it? Okay.
Yeah, other than the odd historical drama, it's kind okay. of a waste of time.
All right. Okay. I get it. I don't watch a lot of TV, but every now and then I love a good Jeopardy. And I tend to annoy the heck out of my family as well, because I'm the one screaming at the TV. Anyway.
One thing that is very true about my family, and it was true about the family I grew up in as well, right, is that the dinner table is a debating club. And you had better bring your best game.
It's interesting you should mention that. I actually talk about that in my upcoming book. I'm not trying to plug, but I am plugging. I actually tell a couple of stories about growing up, about how debate, including political debate, was a normal course of action at our family dinners. It was normal. And you're exactly right. You better bring it, because if you don't, Uncle Dave's going to have your lunch. So
yeah, and my dad was a triple engineer CEO. And my mom was a theologian. So
heart and mind. There you go.
Yes. Just imagine how those debates went, right? I mean, it was
great. But I'll tell you though, there's something interesting there, because when you, in my opinion, when you push science to like the boundary, right? Like I fell down like a quantum mechanics rabbit hole a few years ago. And I started to consume all these books about string theory and quantum mechanics and relativity and all of this stuff. And when you kind of, you know, push Schrodinger's cat all the way to the edge, mm-hmm. you reach this boundary where beyond it kind of starts to look a lot like faith.
Yeah, I have to agree with you.
Right? Like, and
I don't see actually a conflict between what most people call science and what most people call faith, right? The sheer volume. I mean, what defines science?
Well, right.
It's not what we know. It's that which we know we don't know, or that we don't know that we don't know. Right. So, I mean, that's the push, right? We as scientists, we push into that sphere of unknownness.
It's interesting you should say that. Like there's a lot of perspectives here, and you know, some of the smartest people I've ever known all say the same thing. I'll say what you just say, right? Which there is a place to have a conversation about the interplay and the interdependencies and between faith and science, and that there is not necessarily this overt conflict that many would have us believe that there is. So that's not why we're here to talk today. Although that sounds like a heck of a conversation.
That's a cool conversation.
That would be an amazing two fingers of whiskey conversation. Well, that's at least two fingers of whiskey for sure. I may have Canadian whiskey instead of Irish whiskey. I do love my rye, but it's been a while. Anyway, okay. We're not going to talk about religion or philosophy or string theory, but we are going to talk a little bit about data. And Mark's going to talk today about something that is very near and dear to his heart that he knows a lot about, which is a recent ruling out of a Delaware State Court. Okay.
Related to Chancery Court. Yeah.
Okay. Chancery. That sounds fancy.
That's the court that does all business litigation in Delaware, and that because of Delaware's overall position in the corporate firmament, right, nationally and internationally, what it says kind of ripples through other countries. So,
okay, I get it. Kind of like, you know, emissions laws in California.
Exactly. That is a really great idea, right, which I am going to shamelessly steal.
You take it, repurpose as you wish. So I think it is required at this point. I'm sorry, I'm going to do it. Neither Mark nor I, to my knowledge, are lawyers. I know I'm not a lawyer. You're not a lawyer.
No.
Okay.
No, I've been accused of being one by my lawyers, but I am not. No.
Yeah.
I am a member of the American Bar Association and all that kind of stuff. But I do that as a, you know, for reasons. I'm an expert witness. So.
Oh, interesting. Oh, yeah. Okay. That's interesting. Okay. All right. But
anyway. I'm not giving legal advice, but I can speak to it operationally. How's that? Right.
Yeah, this is our safe harbor statement.
General counsel can't.
Yeah, this is our safe harbor statement, Mark. Just run with it. Right. Just we're not lawyers, and all else being equal, seek counsel from your lawyer if you're looking for real legal advice. That's not what we're here to do. We are here to share what we know about this recent ruling related to data and the obligation of people who are in the business of care and feeding of data. So with that, Mark, why don't you spend a few minutes just describing this ruling, describing it, you know, what it said, what it found, describe it at a high level its implications, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so this is all about fiduciary duty, which historically has been a very rarefied idea attached to primarily the board of a company and the CEO. That's usually the limits of it. And it also has historically required a very high bar around proving bad intent, basically, to even have a shot at suing for breach of fiduciary duty. So there was a case that was filed in 2022. By a group of McDonald's, like the hamburgers, shareholders. And it was all about the fact that there was this huge mess around sexual harassment and really bad behavior inside of McDonald's. And so that was identified as a breach of fiduciary duty, failure for the board and the CEO to exercise oversight. And at the last minute, a young associate on the plaintiff side evidently added the name of the CHRO to the suit, didn't have any kind of like legal basis to do so at that time. But this guy was fairly egregious and just felt like he deserved to be on the suit, I guess. So then what happened was keeping the conversation focused, is that in a great surprise landmark ruling coming out of this case, Delaware Chancery Court Vice Chancellor took the opportunity, so like a big time judge, right? Took the opportunity to reset the bar, reset a lot of things about fiduciary duty in any company domiciled in Delaware, but now it's kind of spreading all over the place. So the odds of everybody that's hearing me being impacted have gone way up in the last 2 years. So in January of 2023, this judgment came out, and it's the judgment basically says you no longer have to prove malice or bad intent or anything like that. Pure, just bad faith, and redefining bad faith as negligence, unwillingness to oversee something that's really important. that's enough. And also, for the first time, we are now spreading this responsibility to all corporate officers. Okay. So you got to look at it from, so the premise here was the judge said, modern business has gotten too so complicated that it's there's no way that the board and the CEO can discharge their fiduciary duty to shareholders without the active and integrated support of all officers, because that's where they're getting their information from. What this means is now all corporate officers have individual liability for failure to identify and remediate risks and bad performance in their area. So it's not about, I want to be very clear, this is not about you didn't make your sales goal, you get sued, okay? That's not what this is. This is, I mean, putting it proactively, if I were to go back into a large company as like a chief marketing officer, I would sit down in an offsite with my senior team and I'd say, okay, we're going to do a SWOT analysis, but we're going to really focus on our team and we're going to really focus on our risk factors. And we're going to document those risk factors 9 different ways from Sunday, right? And we're going to document what we think is going to be necessary in terms of time, money, and effort to remediate those risks. And then we're going to file all that upstairs with the general counsel and the CFO. And hopefully we'll get what we need to mitigate those risks. But now they're identified and we can show that we did our part. Right. So on the data side, right, what we're seeing right now is that as shareholders and particularly activist shareholders, and there's, you know, all kinds of flavors of activist shareholder, all kinds of sizes of them. You know, it's not just Elliot and people like that. Right. So they have figured out that virtually every business in America today has a horrendous data situation. If you look at kind of recent surveys and reports and all that kind of stuff, right? It's somewhere, you know, low 90s to mid 90s percentile of data is crap inside of most corporations. It's either crap in terms of quality and accuracy, or it's crap in terms of accessibility. You know, in other words, it's just one way to kind of talk about it more conversationally is this data, can this data support enterprise AI? Mm-hmm. And the answer is usually not a chance, right? Shareholders see that as profound risk, competitively speaking, and lots of other ways, right? And so the lawsuits are starting to accelerate fairly dramatically. And it's really focusing in this area.
So interesting. Let's put a few disclaimers out there. Well, first of all, I should have mentioned this at the top, by the way. Mark is the CEO and founder of ProofAnalytics.ai. They're a causal AI company. We'll talk about that probably a little bit more because there's a connection obviously here to what you do day in and day out. Just wanted to get that out there. Delaware. So this is a state ruling, but Delaware is important because so many companies, particularly big companies, are actually physically, well, not physically, are legally, I should say, domiciled in Delaware. If you are operating all over the place, you are General Motors, you're Ford, you're Tesla, you're whatever. I don't know if those are actually domiciled in Delaware. But do you know, Mark, like what percent of U.S. corporations are domiciled in Delaware?
Like the global 1,000 or something like that, right? It's roughly 2/3 are domiciled in Delaware. Yeah. If you're talking about PE-backed companies, so obviously smaller for the most part, yeah, it's 90%.
Wow. Okay.
Right. Most VCs, for example, mandate that the company be domiciled in Delaware because the case law and everything else is so robust and, you know, they know what they're getting into. Whereas, you know, You put a company domiciled in Wyoming, that's a whole different deal.
Well, right. Yeah. I've got one domiciled in, I've had one in Texas, and I have one now in Florida. And companies choose, have historically chosen Delaware, among other reasons, because of the perception of business and commerce friendly judiciary. Right. That's one of the, that's what
I would say. I would actually correct that slightly. And I would say,
which is
shareholder friendly.
Shareholder friendly. Okay. Interesting.
Texas would business friendly.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough. Well, that chicken has come home to roost in the case of this ruling, because if you've got shareholders saying my shareholder value has been negatively impacted because you didn't manage something properly and I deserve compensation for that. That's basically what the ruling is saying. McDonald's, you screwed up. You knew that there were shenanigans going on. You should have had more controls in place. You didn't. And that extends beyond just the C-suite. Now that gets into officers. Do we know what an officer means?
Yeah, basically, it's you're either named as one, or if you have that word in your title, so
CRO, state officer,
whatever, right? But also, there's a lot of them that don't. They're non-obvious officers, but they are carried as one in the corporation, and there are actually, so one of the more interesting things about this situation is two things, actually. One is we live in probably the most litigious society in the world, and yet nobody has challenged this ruling in 2 years, more than 2 years. No one, right? And so I was talking to some lawyers about this, and I said, do I have any thoughts on this, like why that would be? And they're like, oh, that's easy. CEOs and boards love this because now all the liability is spread out across the company. All these officers share this liability, right? And I'm like, oh, that's, yeah, okay, that's pretty interesting. And indeed, you know, what happened ultimately with McDonald's was they pinned it all on the officer, the CHRO in this case, and let the board and the CEO off the hook. And so, so there's going to be more and more and more of this, right? And then, you know, there'll probably be some tweaks to it, and there'll be a rebalancing of it and all that kind of stuff. But the personal accountability piece is not going away.
Well, so you raised something really interesting. I mean, you started talking about data quality, and it immediately harkens me back to my halcyon days of my youth in the data and analytics space. And the first time I ever landed my own consulting SOW to help a company figure out their data, and I was hired to answer one question. This is I won't name any names, but it was a publicly traded company.
Yeah.
I was hired by a company to answer the question of how many customers do we have? I remember calling my mother that night, my mother and father, and giving them the update. You know, this is the son who's flown the coop and is now, you know, in a different country and doing these cool things. And I said, hey, it's a big day. I got basically my first sale and my, you know, because I've got my own consulting gig. And I said, you know, and they said, oh, well, that's great. What are you going to be doing? I said, well, I'm going to help this company understand how many customers they have. And they're like, what? Yeah. I'm going to help them understand how many customers. What do you mean they don't know how many customers they have? They don't know how many customers they have. Right. And like, but that idea in and of itself, right? This may sound mundane and it may sound silly, but if you are a publicly traded company and you're reporting revenue to the street,
yep,
that is not necessarily backed by data or has fudgy data, or the data quality to your point is very low, where it's possible that number isn't accurate because your data quality is so low. What this ruling is suggesting, and what you suggested previously, is that if you didn't have the right systems in place, the right processes in place, or that you were not doing a sufficient job to manage for data quality, that you could be held reliable. You could be held liable for that in a court of law, at least in the state of Delaware.
Yeah, actually, I was. It went to settlement so fast that I never actually got to play in the game. But there was a
meaning as an expert witness. You'd mentioned,
yeah, right.
An expert. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. The but there was a case, California company, pretty large ish, not like, you know, huge, but pretty damn big, who was a Delaware domiciled company and were sued for breach of fiduciary duty around one thing, and that was their CRM data quality.
Bum, bum, bum.
And I was like, oh, they are so toast, right? Because, I mean, if you've been in the
and I have
tech at all, right? You know, this is like a meme. I right. mean,
yeah,
everyone knows that it's screwed up, right? And so the plaintiffs got the judge to authorize the install of a piece of software that's used to, it's patterning type software used to find patterns of fraud. It's used a lot in FISA companies. And basically, a little more than two thirds of 14 years worth of CRM data came back as, I think that the polite term was engineered.
Like Theranos engineered, like that level of, because that gets to intent, right? Like that's,
yeah, that's correct. So like a lot of them, this company was really well known in the sales area for doing SPIF programs.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
To mainly accelerate, you know, to incentivize deals to move faster, to sales guys to get with the program. And so, and they, because of the rules, they found a lot of evidence that deals were not declared when they were actually should have been declared. And so they were triggering these extra payments illegitimately. So now this company probably, I don't know this for a fact, obviously, but is probably sitting there going, okay, so like we have like a bunch of people that we probably need to go claw money back from, but is that realistic? And do we really want to go do that? And, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But it was bad. And they got a sealed deal, sealed settlement, right? Which is why you haven't heard about it.
Right, exactly.
But it's a huge amount of money.
So this is fascinating. So you're a former CMO of a Fortune 500 company. You are an expert in AI, data and AI. So you are the expert witnesses getting brought into these cases, right? Mm-hmm. You're getting to see, you know, the kind of sausage being made on the fly, at least from the perspective of litigation around some of this stuff. You just gave one example of that. You talked about CRM data, and yeah, it is a meme, right? It is a meme, but there are so many things in this that we could be talking about here. The list is just, it's just so long. I mean, how many sales organizations have you worked with where there wasn't tomfoolery going around from a forecasting and a pipeline perspective, right? Everybody.
Yeah, that would be the only answer would be zero.
Exactly. Like gamesmanship around, and I'm not casting aspersion and I'm not casting judgment. It just is what it is. Gamesmanship around sales pipelines and forecasts, right? Salespeople don't want to necessarily be held too much, or they sandbag, or they, you know, like all of the gamesmanship around how deals are being reported and managed in a CRM. What you just said, now this was a little bit different. This is like paying sales spiffs on deals that hadn't actually happened potentially, but I could easily foresee a situation where that if you as the CDO or the CMO either, or the CIO, pick, go ahead, depending on the organization, didn't have enough processes in place to make sure and didn't have enough controls in place to make sure that the inaccuracies in that world weren't flowing into what was being reported on a 10K or 10Q, that is a huge problem.
That's a very huge problem. I think that for a longest, so like if Delaware had passed this ruling 10 years ago, right, it would have been marginally enforceable.
Right.
Right. What is really happening today is it's incredibly enforceable, right? AI in general, not just causal AI, other kinds of pattern match AI, right, is able to rapidly figure this out, right? And so it's a very, very interesting conundrum. We have all of us, me, you, right? We've all operated within what I call a zone of ambiguity for most of our lives. And that zone of ambiguity was actually quite large. I define the zone of ambiguity as where my representation may carry just as much weight as yours. Kind of depends almost all on my ability to present well, or present better than you, and all that kind of stuff. That is shrinking substantially. I mean, one of the things that AI, particularly causal AI, is going to be in the future is a giant bullshit detector on all kinds of things. And it's just going to be a lot harder to fade the heat.
Fade the heat or claim ignorance.
Yeah, because everything will be known or knowable.
Right. Okay, that's fascinating. So as you're listening to this, if you find this interesting, I would invite you to check out next week's or 2 weeks from now's episode where I'm interviewing Bar Moses. Bar is the CEO of a company called Monte Carlo. And Monte Carlo is what's called data observability, where what they're focused on is, for lack of a better word, forensics around data and understanding some of these patterns that Mark was just talking about, right? Like patterns that would lead you to, would lead anybody to naturally conclude there's fraud happening here, or patterns that would lead you to conclude that there is some massive data quality issues that could otherwise have been stopped through better controls or better process or better governance. So a lot of these issues are kind of coming and coalescing together. But what you're saying is there's increasingly no more plausible deniability. There's no more sticking our head in the sand.
And I'll tell you this too, right? I mean, the natural human brain functions as a correlative machine, right? Mm-hmm. Pattern match. The problem is that as causal becomes more and more accessible, then you have to worry about the delta. So I actually did some work, like mathematically, like really kind of like got into it and had, you know, four different tools double check me, and had a mathematician who's, you know, wouldn't want me to use his name, but he's like one of the very best in the world. He double checked it. So you ask, let's say you pose five different questions and you ask correlative math for an answer and you ask causal math for an answer. Everybody, I think, that with a brain cell knows that there's going to be some difference, but it is actually really staggering how much difference. It's between 3,000 and 7,000 basis points of difference. That's just the norm, right? So that's 30% to 70% delta on the two answers. So the ability to rely on correlation outside of certain clearly indicated use cases and all that kind of stuff, right, is just not there, right? And so you're going to have to really, like, one of the things that's already being asked in these depositions is, they get really technical. They're saying, how do you know What technique are you using to understand this? And if it's the wrong one, then you're kind of cooked.
Meaning, okay, so the wrong one being, in this case, some idea of a correlation, meaning I'm a CDO and I'm trying to understand buyer behavior. For example, I'm trying to understand buyer behavior because I report expected future sales maybe to the street as a part of some sort of filing exercise, safe harbor agreement, safe harbor notwithstanding, forward-looking statements notwithstanding. Mm-hmm. I'm still, as a CEO or CFO, I'm still going to probably say, we are bullish on the next quarter.
Right.
And if in a court of law, somebody asks you, okay, how did you conclude that you're going to be bullish? Right. How did you conclude that you are optimistic about the sale of this product? And you said, well, I did a correlation between A and B, and we know A is going to happen, and we rely on B for our product sales. That's how I came at my data. That court is liable to say, okay, not good enough.
Yeah, absolutely not good enough. Because
if A didn't become true, by
the world is not a one-on-one relationship, right?
Right.
Okay. And so what I do think is a legitimate answer is, we used different kinds of correlative techniques. We used causal inference techniques, and we did like statistic techniques, right? Or something like that, right? I mean, so we looked at it through a variety of different lenses and we triangulated, and that's where we came out, right? I think that right there is the kind of answer, in the context of the ruling that would be almost impossible for a plaintiff lawyer to get past.
Okay. So
we're kind of belt and suspenders, right?
You're right. So before we get into our last discussion, which will be around what do we do? Acknowledging there's probably no one answer here. Before we get into the kind of what would we do? What should CDOs do? I do want to just kind of focus on, something we had talked about before we started recording, which is this idea that Delaware tends to be a bit of a bellwether for the rest of the country. This idea of California emissions, right? And what happens in California from an emissions perspective almost ends up happening everywhere else. There are a lot of our listeners who are maybe listening from outside the United States, including Canada and Europe, are like, well, wait a minute, why does one court in Delaware even matter, right? Why does one state court in Delaware? Well, it matters because there's a lot of companies, and it also matters because other states will start to adopt these rules over time. Is there a possibility, though? Of course, I already know the answer to this, but let's talk, this is very briefly about, legislation in and of itself, right? We talked about Sarbanes-Oxley and, how that was a legislation and it took a long time to kind of dribble out. Took a number of years to kind of really take a foothold. Are we seeing the same thing here? Would we expect that maybe the legislative branch will take some action either to harden this or maybe undercut it? What are you hearing out there?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think that in the case of Delaware's own legislature, they're actually trying to go a little bit the other way and make Delaware, because there's some big tech firms that are making noise about leaving Delaware for the Wyoming or the Freedom of Texas or whatever.
Yeah. Right?
I think that the legislature, for that matter, legislatures in general, really prefer the courts to be the iron asses of policy, right? And so they're going to totally let the Chancery Court in Delaware do that. However, Texas has already started to cite the Delaware ruling in its cases. Oklahoma, these are clearly redder than red states, right, are going this way. California, New York. So those are two blue states. So I think that there's a general view that this is good, not bad. And I think that, one of the things that's going to be a little bit awkward, I mean, let's kind of call it what it is when AI really takes hold in the decision-making and vetting processes of corporations, we're all going to find out, you know, kind of like how wrong we were, right? On a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's not going to be, there's going to be no respecter of persons, no respecter of rank, nothing, right? I mean, it's a totally different situation, but this is something LinkedIn is grappling with. They 70%, according to them, of the content on the platform is bullshit.
Yeah, AI generated. Yeah.
And it's just, but even if it's not, it's still
right. It's just, human baloney versus machine baloney.
And you just kind of sit there and say, and people kind of like at some level understand that that's true, right? And so it devalues the platform, and they're kind of wondering how they can best fight that. And I may have said something like, well, you're just going to have to put a little bullshit meter on people's pages, right?
That's tough.
Of course, they don't really want to do that. And I understand why they don't want to do that. But it really does kind of come down to that.
So this is another tangent and another rabbit hole that we could fall down, right? Like, because, you know, getting back to the idea of proof, but a bump. You and I have been in the business world and been in data, been in senior leadership roles. You know, we can generally smell this stuff a mile away. Mm-hmm. Smelling it and inferring it and deriving it is very different than proving it at scale from the perspective of a LinkedIn. Right. Yeah. And proving it, and what I mean by scale, like in an automated way. Right. So that's a really hard problem to solve, you know, especially since there are gradations. You and I have actually had some very interesting kind of back and forth on this in terms of like what is true and what is not true. And some of the rigor that you apply to some of your posts, which is like incredibly laudable, by the way. Like if you ever read anything from Mark Stuess on LinkedIn, just know that it's been vetted and that Mark actually has like a structured process for vetting his own content and feeding it through multiple systems to make sure that he's not saying anything that's total crap. So I sleep
so much better at night.
Right. Well, yeah. And you should be lauded for that. And I absolutely, you know, I'm two thumbs up entirely on that. But I also acknowledge that, you know, this notion of truth can be contextually bound, and there are objectives and objective truths, and there are subjective truths at times.
And that's actually one reason why I think it's really important to stay away from that word.
What, truth?
Yeah.
It's loaded. Loaded.
I think that I speak about facts.
Yes. But the argumentarian in me, you know, facts can change over time, and they always do.
Our understanding of some facts changes.
Yes. Over time, yes. Right? This is why LinkedIn remains actually a really wonderful place to hang out and meet smart people like Mark Stuess. and I love it. Anyway, we digress. Let's get back to, okay, I'm the CDO and I know I got some problems, because I don't know any CDOs that don't have a lot of problems when it comes to data quality, when it comes to data management, data governance, you name it. This sounds a little scary to me. Sounds a little daunting to me. Maybe I just might want to go open that winery instead, or go do the passion play instead. But let's assume that I'm passionate about data and I want to keep doing what I'm doing. Is this a 5-alarm fire, a 3-alarm fire, a 1-alarm fire?
I think it is actually a 5-alarm fire for a lot of reasons. I'm actually in a situation right now with a client where they're being asked why they have so much data. And so I was in the room and I said, well, can you give a little more color on why do you care about data volume? Well, it costs a lot to collect it, secure it, manage it, et cetera. And if you're not getting active value, decision-making value from a lot of this data, then why do you have it? Why are we having to pay for it? Right? And I said, that's actually a completely legitimate answer, which my client didn't particularly like that I said that, but it's the truth. So I believe in giving that whenever I can, right? It helps in the end. And in this case, it did, right? So I think you have to, if you're a CDO, number one, you have to realize that you're on a nexus of accountability with other officers. So for example, the CRM situation, right? There were three officers named. And the more I kind of thought about it, the more this was sort of like a personalization of the people, process, technology triangle, right? So you had the CRO, who was clearly the, you know, had people governance, you know, making sure that his sales guys didn't go off the reservation. You had the CIO, which probably of the three had the least liability, because all he did was own the tool and the pipes, right? And then you had the CDAO, who was radically exposed because there was no policy around data quality that was discoverable at all, right? And so, and each one of them could have easily gotten zapped, right? And I think you also have to realize this is not just about your financial, personal financial liability, which would typically be covered by an insurance policy of some sort, right? It's about your reputational hit.
Yeah.
Right?
Sure.
And so, I mean, it's talking about putting your money where your mouth is. So I think that you have to say, and I think this is where the data is oil thing actually does work better than some people think. So data is crude oil. If you put it in your engine, it's not going to take you where you want to go, and it's going to wreck your engine, right? So that's just, but if you refine it, right, into gasoline, benzene, and all the other distillates that come off that column, right, then you've got something of real value, which, by the way, the refined value is what implicitly gives the raw material its value. So I think that you have to say that until you pass your data through analytics, you don't really know the value of what you have, because you don't really know how much better the decision making will be as a result of all of this working, right? And if we stop and think about it for a second, using kind of, we go way back into just basic multivariable regression, okay? Gives you a multiplier number. So it happens in causal AI as well, right? That multiplier number is really important. You could argue, particularly for nonlinear contributions, right? That is the number. That's the score, right? So if you are a data science team, if you're a CDAO, you would want to know, for example, that because you and your team exist, that the business teams are making decisions that are, I don't know, I'm pulling this out of my ear here, 5 times, 6 times, 7 times, 8 times better than they were before they had access to data and analytics, right? You want to talk about justifying your position in the company? Holy crap, man. That's it. That's where I'd go with it, right? I mean, I'm trying to address it quickly and from a real high level, right? But I think that if you go bottoms up in it, you're going to end up in the same place that every person ever ends up. And if you go tops down, which is essentially leading with analytics, what sort of analytics, what sort of business questions are there? What kind of analytics do we need to answer those questions? What does that model look like? What's the punch list of the data types needed to feed that model on a regular basis, right? that's kind of the deconstruction that has to happen. And again, I'm making it really conversational here, but.
So I completely agree with you. So to paraphrase, forget about any sort of bottoms up assessment here, right? It's not going to happen. Any framework driven, bottom up driven, inventory driven assessment of like, man, I got to go look at all of my data and all of my processes and all of my systems and all of my people and all of these things, never going to happen. You'll spend the next 20 years trying to get to the point of like reasonable understanding of how all these things are connected. What Mark is saying, that a reasonable first step at this, addressing this 5-alarm fire, maybe taking it to a 4 or 3 alarm fire, is to understand a few key things. One would be drivers of value from a data perspective. And another one would be major drivers of risk, right? Getting back to the kind of the risk component. You can quantify those things, right? Risk from the perspective of, you know, accuracy of your financials. Yeah. Risk from you name it, like supply chain risk, you name it. Like you'd be able to identify what some of the biggest drivers of risk are. Focus on the big picture things. Focus on the things that are going on to your any of your C-level reports and work backwards from there. That's what you're saying, right, Mark?
Yeah, and I'll add this other thing because it's a personal human thing. It's an organizational thing, right? So right now, largely because of some of the stuff that we're talking about, right, data science teams, CDAO organizations are being subordinated to finance at a greater and greater and greater rate. Okay. And of course, the data scientists are pissed.
Well, there's nothing creative about financials, but anyway, go on.
In the same way that 25 years ago, IT organizations were pissed when they were subordinated to finance, right? What's going on here is they're not saying that they know how to do your job better than you. What they're saying is, we're going to get you far more aligned with the business, right? Your business acumen is going to improve. We're going to make sure that it improves so that the business gets the value that it needs, right? And so, and also, I would just like to point this one little thing out. If you're in data science and you're in a big company and you need data from fill in the blank organization, right? And you go to them, send them an email and say, hey, I need this data. The likelihood, unfortunately, is that you'll get brushed off or just told no or whatever, right? But when you work for finance, who in the world ever says no to a data request from finance?
Bingo.
Nobody.
Yep.
Nobody. Right? You can lose your job for telling finance no. So that's, I would rejoice in it. In fact, if I were a CDAO, I'd be lobbying to become a part of the CFO organization.
It's funny you should mention that, because that was one thing I was waiting to actually say. As we wind up the podcast, I was going to say, hey, you know, there's good news here and there's bad news. The bad news is there may be a 5-alarm fire. The good news here is that compliance and audit and regulatory risk or legal risk drives a lot of investment in business. It always has, right? Yeah. It always has. And that could end up actually being a good thing in your favor. And that's exactly what Mark just said, which is, hey, don't be afraid of closer aligning yourself to the CFO. And don't necessarily be afraid of using this as a lever, right? As a lever. Now, fear can only...
It is a lever.
Right.
You need to pull on the lever, right? Right.
Yeah. Now, don't, you know, fear can only take you so far. I would argue that if the only value story you're telling is I can help you not get sued, well, that's you'll get the minimum required to not get sued. So, you know, I think we should aspire higher. And Mark just talked about that, like from the perspective of like understanding what some of your key value drivers are. These are all great things. Mark, you and I could probably, you know, talk for days. We do need to find a way to do the 2 to 4 fingers of whiskey sometime, some way. That would be great.
Can I say one last thing?
Of course, you're the guest. It's
really short.
Yeah, go for it.
Guys, particularly those of you who came up in data science in the last, say, 15 years, okay, where machine learning. Machine learning is great. Okay. It does a lot of things really well. It is not data science. Data science is much bigger than machine learning, right? So if you kind of say, I mean, like in causal AI right now, you see some people trying to do causal ML, double ML, all this kind of stuff, okay? And it's like they totally missed the key message in high school or college stat class that correlation does not imply causality, right? You can't get there from here, right? And so you just need to kind of really be thinking about that, particularly in the context of business, where almost everything is a causal question.
Well, right. And if you can do this, and you can do this well, and you can articulate to companies, I suspect you could pretty much write your own ticket from a wage perspective. So that being said, thank you to everybody for listening to another episode of CDO Matters Podcast. Hey, FYI, if we stick to the current schedule, my book, The Data Hero Playbook, will publish next week, July 3rd, in which I talk actually a lot about these subjects. I don't talk about the Delaware ruling per se, but I talk a lot about aligning yourself closer to the business. I talk a lot about accountability. So if you are looking to understand how to be a better data leader, about how to use data as a lever of innovation of your organization, check out the Data Hero Playbook, available Amazon.com, July 3rd, next week. Mark Stuess, thank you. You are brilliant, my friend. Thanks for the insight. We need to stay in touch. Thanks for coming out. To everybody else, we will see you on another episode of CDO Matters sometime very soon. Thanks all. Bye for now.